Blog Talk Radio.
Gideon Wright with Dr. Bowles. Good afternoon. I am so glad to have you join me. If you had a chance to go to the marquee, you have seen today's topic was expectations of justice, getting your just deserves. I guess I was inspired to talk about this because we've been talking over the last few weeks about social justice, and most of the conversation has been directed outward, that justice is something that is legislated or enforced. It's kind of like pornography. Everyone can define it in their own way, but they know it when they see it. Well, just if you look from an introspective point of view, meaning the group that's seeking justice, we have to think about what makes justice happen. In other words, if I'm by myself, anything I do, as long as it's not hurting an outward natural force, is justice. I can sleep to noon if I want to. I can eat a whole cake, a pint of ice cream. I can ignore whatever rules, turn the lights on in the middle of the night, play my music as loud as I like, because I'm a singular factor. And when there comes a secondary factor, a partner, a friend, a dormitory, a barracks situation, then those freedoms that I had when I was on my own are no longer mine. And you enter into the concept of what's just, what's fair. If there are 10 people in a room and they all need sleep, and I choose to play loud music after the time that most have gone to sleep, is that an act of injustice to those who need those 9 hours of sleep? If I tend to be cold-natured and I hate air conditioning and I turn it off when everyone else is sweating and uncomfortable, is that justice? So if you look at it from all angles, the concept of social justice, the concept of justice in general, it almost says that the entire group that is involved, must be in agreement. And I think therein lies the problem. When you look at social justice, unless the groups are of like mind, like background, like heritage, they're not going to have as much agreement on what is the right thing to do, what is the worst thing to do, who is benefiting, who's not benefiting, and what should be done to allocate the right thing and the wrong thing. Well, if you read the marquee, it is very difficult to allocate. If you have someone in power who's going to make sure everyone complies, then there's already a skew of power. That if I have the jurisdiction or the hand or the ability to make you do what I think is right, then you've lost some of your freedom because I'm imposing a centralized. What is best for all should be, what is best for none is best for all, or so forth. Does expectations, is a question that I pose in today's discussion, direct the implementation of justice? Well, let's talk a little bit about definition of expectation. Expectation, from all that I could find, says a strong belief that something will happen or be the case in the future. I can expect the sun to rise. My expectation is sunrise tomorrow. It says to do or be someone or something in another one's point of view. Now, this one's a touchy one because there can be people who put false expectations upon you, and many failed marriages, relationships, very discordant families, their problems have come from someone or a number of members expecting something of another. In other words, they've displaced or they've transferred an expectation to someone else. Another meeting said there's a belief about that which might happen in the future. I would expect that when you have a young child, you're expecting them to grow up. You may expect them to go to college. You may expect them to be married. But you have some kind of belief that something's going to happen, and you're projecting it toward the future. The word expectation is of a Latin origin, and the word in Latin translates to an awaiting. If you've ever had motivational speakers, I think Joel Osteen's probably leading the pack. I listen to him when I need to have that, go get them, everybody can do it, this is all for you. The motivational speaker inspires great expectation. They're telling you you can and you should expect and you should believe and this is what you can do. And they have you to believe that something good is coming your way. So you have these wonderful expectations. The one that I'm really more concerned with, and it's really the topic for today, is what happens if a people, for whatever reason, some would say chronic persecution, some would say generational defeatism, some would say slave mentality. So what I'm going to talk about is fear that causes a responsible individual to teach a dependent child to never expect, never assume, never ask, never demand, just let it be. If it's meant to be, it will happen. They're always advising the child to keep expectations low so the risk of disappointment is low. I know some women who actually date on that premise, that if they don't expect a man to be handsome, if they don't expect a man to be loyal, if they don't expect a man to have a good income, then they can feel comfortable getting a man who is disloyal, who does not bring home money, and who does chase women outside of that arrangement, outside of that relationship. So my question really is it the expectations that sets the bar for justice? Wouldn't it be an elegant ruse if a dominant group of people could convince another group of people that they should not expect the same kind of car, the same kind of money, the same kind of education, the same kind of school, same kind of living arrangement, that they should set their expectations low. Set their expectations low enough, they'll never be disappointed. They won't have nice houses, they won't have nice cars, they won't have a good education. But they'll be left alone. Well, I propose that this is exactly what has gone on in the United States of America. That there are a group of Black Americans who have accepted that point of view. That if you don't have high expectations, you won't have big disappointments. So if you don't request to sit at the front of the bus, they'll leave you alone sitting in the back. If you don't request to go to their schools, they'll leave you alone in your schools. And in order to accept this, you have to have a certain kind of submissiveness, a certain blindness. You look for the best in the worst situation. Now, in the United States of America, I've interacted with actually groups of people who are Black Americans. That's my primary interface professionally and in my personal life. Now, professionally, I was always the outlying, the first Black female this and the first, because what they were really saying is in the environment or the arenas in which I competed, went to school, lived, were not meant to include black or females. And I always smile when I hear that salute that was the first black anything, particularly in the 2015, because what they're really doing is declaring how closed, how prejudicial, how narrow whatever this organization is saluting the first black has been over these years. I say that because it is simply saying this is the first person of color of this gender that we have allowed to participate fully, be judged completely on the merits of their execution. So if it took you this long in the United States with 1776 to 2015 to come to a point where you can allow someone of contributing substance, obviously, because you're saluting them, that you allow them now to be recognized and would not have simply because of the color of their skin and their gender. So I think that they need to wake up and stop that labeling, because when I hear it, I kind of cringe because I look at it as, so you've been this long in the dark, you've been this backwards for this long, that this organization, if it were not created this year, then you've been making prejudiced decisions or not even allowing competition from that particular group. I do know that there are black Americans in authority, in position of training young people who advocate the submissive, passive, apathetic, don't say anything, you didn't see anything behavior. My attribution is that they are afraid. I have some friends and colleagues who have other labeling of that type of mentality. I went to Kwanzaa December 26th, I think the second day of Kwanzaa. I haven't participated in Kwanzaa widely. I didn't understand the premise, didn't know why a California University black professor thought it was necessary to create, as he said, something for black Americans to celebrate, which was uniquely theirs, around which is the biggest celebrated holiday in the United States, Christmas. While I was participating in the activities of Kwanzaa, they had a panel discussion. And on the panel, there were some questions about, is it advisable to tell young black men how to behave in this white majority population? It was coming off of the Trayvon Martin's killing and how the great big thing about he had a hoodie it seemed to demonize that if you had a hoodie and you were black and you're in this white neighborhood, oh my goodness, you couldn't be up to any good and therefore justify shooting on sight. So the discussion of the panel members were, what is the obligation of the black family or the black patriot or matriot in preparing young black men, that was the focus of the conversation, to be safe, just casually safe. I mean, you see the overt stuff. You know, I've been called the N-word, and I've been knocked down with a bicycle by some little white boys that ran us down. We were walking home from school. I had some white neighbors when I was very young. My parents did. They came down, and one little boy held my sister and myself hostage with a little gun that he had. I forget, just a pop gun or a cork in the gun. He'd shoot it and it would fly out and hit you, and he could put it back in and fly it out and hit you again. And we were held at gunpoint, if you like, while his cousin came and kicked all the playthings down. We were doing tea house or whatever children do, and they destroyed our setup, which was very modest, I assure you. But that experience stays with me, that they felt they had the right to come into our dominion. We were in our backyard and disrupt our play and use force to do it. Now, we were not 10-year-old. Nobody in that entire dynamic was 10-year-old. I think we're anywhere from, say, 6 to 9, including the two white children who came down and molested us. So the teaching, getting back on point, the panel, there were several people on the panel, black people, black professionals, who said there was an obligation in the black American community for the older people to groom the younger ones and tell them you shouldn't wear this in certain settings and you shouldn't do this. And there was this mighty discussion. Some thought that if the person doing the instruction was of that mind, then they were in fact accepting of second-class citizen. They were accepting the concept of subordinate, and they were teaching or propagating that acceptance to whomever they were talking to, that you cannot wear, let's just say, a hoodie in any white neighborhood after 10 o'clock. A self-imposed penalty thing, this young person from the violence we saw perpetrated against Trayvon Martin. I listened, I heard both sides' arguments. Someone argued very strongly that we need to teach our children not to be afraid. We need to teach our children to understand that they're supposed to have the right to walk in any street, in any place in the United States, without harm, and that this should be an expectation and therefore a right. So that was kind of like a very hot rock being juggled. Then what is the responsibility of the patriot or the matriarch? Do we think about Black American preservation in the midst of a hostile, capitalistic, controlling environment and perpetuate a sense of fear that in order to stay here, in order to maintain our position, we have to hold our peace? And we say that would be the camp of passivity, the idea of meekness. Or on the other hand, there's a group that says, give us our own. Let us pull away from you. You don't care for us. You don't want us in your midst. Then let us have what we have, and we will leave you alone. And then there are others who say we must demand what we have already earned, that if 600 years people got rich because they paid no salaries to my ancestors, that they had crops and they had big houses and now they've got trust funds and offshore banking, and my people, so many generations down, are still living subpar. They don't own property. They don't have the things that would be rightfully theirs had the slave trade and industry that grew on the backs of slavery had not existed in the United States. Well, I don't have an answer. I was simply in my musing, dissecting what I thought was an introspective position for justice. I am now in a class, and when talking about justice, a number of the participants brought up black-on-black crime, and I certainly was tempted to give statistics on how that is bellied as a big deal, but the bottom line is the number of black people dying at black people's hands are no greater than those dying at the white people's hands. So to say black-on-black crime is bigger, better, worse, more heinous, I'm not sure, because many of the black-on-black crimes are perpetrated by white-instituted situations. You say, oh, where are we going? Well, I don't want to lead down a political trail, but if you look at drug wars or drug sales in the urban setting, and you're saying, okay, this black person shot another black person, it was about drug money. Well, if you keep looking at it, I don't know of, and perhaps if someone does, they can educate me, any major black American who is a billionaire bringing in drugs to the United States. I don't know of anyone who has private planes or private yachts or have immunity, you know, embassy immunity. because the drugs that get in the neighborhoods that result in the killing came from somewhere. And when they started talking about get hard on drugs, the joke of it is it meant arrest more minorities. It's not the minorities who were bringing the drugs to the community, but the minorities were the ones incarcerated. So, I mean, it's laughable if you can step back and look at the big picture, that it's a puppet game. There's these marionettes with the strings and the controls, and they can make it look however they want depending on what strings they're pulling at the time. In the last broadcast, I talked about how there has been a decision to release 6,000 prisoners by November 2nd who are in prison because of drug charges, and predominantly marijuana drug charges, that during the time of Get Tough on Drugs, if you did not know it, more Hispanic, Latino, Blacks were sentenced to long sentences, 15, 25 years, life in prison for potential distribution of crack cocaine and marijuana. And somewhere along the way in 2010 through 2012, there was a review of the constitutionality of these kinds of decisions, and a commission decided that it was not okay to have put people in prison for those long periods of time when today no one would go to prison at all for the very crimes that they're serving their life sentence. And the question mark is, how do you give somebody back their life if you take 15 years of a young man's life and then say, okay, now you can go home, and this young man has missed so much. There is no reformation. No one's giving you a check and saying here. No one is giving you a college education. No one's giving you free housing. They're just saying go home. They're still going home with a felony on their record. They're still going home with probation on their head. And it's kind of a painful, I can't even say laughable, a painful dynamic when the news media would say they are releasing, but no one follows to say what happens to them once they're out. The American society, United States of American society, is very toxic. And the one thing that I've found is the more I learn, the more painful it is, that the concept of power, the conceptualism, at the expense of everyone, at the expense of anyone. I was watching a program on Pivot. That's one of the channels that give individual entrepreneurs an opportunity to present their stories, much of what they present are documentary-type stories. And it was a most interesting profile on agriculture. And in these United States, we like to talk about Putin and Russia and the Gestapo. We have a Gestapo in the United States. They were interviewing a number of farmers who were saying that if they tried to harvest their own seed and plant a crop from their seed, then they would be accosted by private investigators that work for Monsanto, which is the largest agricultural seed manufacturer in the world now. They bioengineered seeds that would resist the chemicals they spray to kill weeds. Then they got Congress to pass a law that said they could patent this particular DNA, which was implemented in these seeds. And if a farmer is using a crop that does not contain their patent, they can take them to court. They can say that you are infringing on our patent, and the hollowness of that argument, the painfulness of that argument, is that they've essentially challenged Mother Nature, that Monsanto, not Mother Nature, decides what crops can be grown in the world. There are many people who fear that this is going to be our doomsday, that this is going to be the collapse of our civilization when we start patenting living things and have a few, not many, and having a monoculture, not diverse culture. I listen to these young farmers talking about having someone knock on their door and serve them with court papers, infringement on patent. They've been surveillanced, they've been followed. There's an 800 number. Monsanto invites farmers who suspects their colleagues of not using Monsanto products to call and inform them so the harassment can begin. For those of us who are on the sidelines, what that's got to do with me? Well, if you eat food, if you go to the grocery store, if you shop at any kind of large commercial department store, you are in fact contributing to this mentality. If you find that concept unconscionable, then you have to do something. And you say, well, wait a minute, I don't know, I'm not political, I don't get involved. Part of the group's discussion that I caught, and this to me has a lot to do with expectations, has a lot to do with social justice, that we, the people at large, I'm saying the pronoun we to me, people at large, we're like zombies now. There are too few of us thinking about what's really going on. We're just going along. We are on assembly line. One young man was talking about how there used to be all these nice delis in your neighborhood, the mom-and-pop shops, and then came the big guys like Burger King and McDonald's and Wendy and Taco Bell, and they made it a fast food kind of country. And now cows are not grazing freely out on the fields and eating what Mother Nature said they should eat. Man has decided to feed them orchestrated diets. And when they didn't give enough milk, then they started injecting hormone. And when the hormone started creating mastitis or infections in the udder, they started giving them antibiotics. And what is this spiraling problem doing? Our young women become mature between the age of 9 and 12, where it used to be 15 to 18. We have so much more effeminization. We know that there are certain hormones and certain antibiotics that can stimulate effeminization. If it's known, why do we keep doing it? Then we start worrying about same-sex marriages, and we worry about the legislation against homosexuality. We worry about the legislation against termination of a pregnancy. But yet we do nothing to stop these problems at its beginning, its origin. We are what we eat. We are what we drink. If you drink milk laden with antibiotics, you will have more disease. You will have autoimmune kinds of complications. If we eat over-refined breads that have genetically modified components and DNA, we don't know what the ultimate outcome is because we are this big living experiment. Nobody checked. No one said what happens if we feed pigs and cows genetically modified corn. What happens to the meat, and what happened to the people who eat the meat? We had a catastrophe, if some of you may remember, with mad cow disease. And we had an outbreak in Canada, an outbreak here in the United States, relatively small, and we had an outbreak also in Europe. The reason that they had the problem is they were using the brains of sheep. They were grinding it up, drying it, grinding it up, and feeding it to cows. Cows are herbivores. They eat grass. They eat hay. Why are they feeding them something as estrogenous as brain matter? So all I can say, if you stick your head in the sand, or if you go through this passiveness that let's just get along, let's all love everybody, let's forgive everybody, then the person who may be finally hurt will be you. So social justice, expectations, the whole human race. We need to step back, take a deep breath, and start cleaning house. With that, I say be safe. And I look forward to our next time when we can get together and just have a conversation. So with that, I'd say bye now.